Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music. Hey, welcome to Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Matt Barber and Michelle Santoro. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Zach Lepofsky and Adam Stein. They're the duo behind Freaks, a new movie out on VOD today. If you missed it in theaters, you can check it out now on VOD. It's a cool sci-fi thriller, kind of genre-bending, mashup sort of story, and it's from two really exciting filmmakers who have like a long journey. I feel like that's a theme that we're still hitting away on, still really enjoying here on the show, but like their whole experience in making the film and then selling it, you know, pretty successfully and like finding a home in theaters is a great story about basically just kind of going back to basics and like sticking to it. Yeah. Figuring out what does it take to make a movie and just going for it.
These guys are super amazing resumes. Adam's directed for Jimmy Kimmel. Zach was a producing director on a TV show for Disney. They've done so much, but what really inspired them was one speech, the speech from Mark Duplass.
At the South by South keynote a couple years ago.
Yeah, and that's what got them off their butts and had them make their own movie that turned into this movie Freaks, which has an awesome cast, Bruce Dern, Emile Hirsch, Amanda Crew from Silicon Valley, and a new actress, young actress, that sounds really good. We talk about how they auditioned her, how they found her, how they made this movie, and how they met, which is, to me, the most fascinating part of it all.
Yeah, spoiler, it was on a TV show.
Yeah, like that they were on. Yeah. Not as actors, but as directors. So that might give away a little bit of what that show was, but
yeah,
listen up because it's real interesting.
It is a wild ride. And the other really cool thing about these two is that while they're living the indie dream, the indie fairy tale, they're also still working directors, and they really personify that kind of double life that we're all hoping to lead, where you get to have your cake and eat it too. They're making TV shows, they're directing stuff all the time as work for hire directors, but also still making time for their passion projects. And those are the things that, as we all know, really pay off, and they are living proof of how their passion projects have elevated their careers time and again.
And on a side note, and I swear it's totally unrelated to the fact that they're on this podcast, but Zach's company, Shotlister, he created an app that helps you keep track of your shot lists on set, which was actually an unpaid endorsement by a previous guest of ours, Ben Giroux. They had sponsored our show, unrelated to this interview, but I asked Zach today if people could still get free copies of Shotlister. So if you're listening to this episode and you are interested in trying out this app, which is not inexpensive, you can get it for Mac OS, iOS, or Android. You can email justshootitpod@shotlister.com and just tell them what version of the app you want. You'll get it for free. So pretty cool thing for our listeners.
Pretty cool. It was funny.
Convinced Zach to keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. It was legitimately funny. Like, we got an email from their PR person that was like, hey, do you know these two cool filmmakers, Zach Lepofsky? And we were like, yeah.
Yeah. And then I saw the creative screenwriting. You know, Jeffrey Goldsmith was doing a screening of their movie. Like, they kind of made the rounds very much with their movie, not to mention it premiered at TIFF and, you know, all these other cool things. So anyway, it's a really cool conversation. I learned a lot. I mean, my favorite thing was about how they auditioned that little girl and how they found her. I thought that's definitely something I will steal.
Unorthodox for sure. Love it.
Yeah. Before we talk to them, we're going to tell you about our Patreon real quick. If you go to patreon.com/justshootitpod, you can find out more about our Patreon and why we're doing it. But it's basically a way that our listeners, if they feel like they're getting something out of the show, if they're regular, if you're a regular listener, if you listen to us every Thursday when we upload a new episode and you want to help us out to pay our editors and everyone else and just kind of give us a little bit of litmus test that people are listening and people are excited about the show and people want us to keep making it, then check it out. You can give $1 a month. If you give $10, even for only 1 month, you'll get a Just Shoot It podcast hat that you can wear.
And I like to think of it as you're buying snacks for our guests. The snack budget is not insignificant.
Yes. Kara, my wife, keeps reminding me of that.
Wow. Keep us in pita chips and dark chocolate, everybody.
And some wine every once in a while.
Well, guys, thanks so much for making it out here. Let's talk about Freaks just kind of off the bat, yeah?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, Freaks has been kind of our passion project for the last 5 or 6 years. Between writing it and getting it financed, getting it made, getting it finished, and then getting it into theaters has been kind of an epic journey. And
can you give us the long
line? Sort of overwhelming.
Yeah, I mean, Freaks is about a 7-year-old girl who spent her whole life inside of this one house because her father says, if you ever go outside, people will kill you or they'll kill both of us. And so at the beginning of the movie, you're not quite sure, is he telling the truth? What's outside? Is it normal? Is it zombies? Is it, who knows what's going on?
And there's all this weird stuff happening in the house where people are materializing and there's weird
interesting
sounds, so, and ghosts. And
yeah. But the audience is like, yeah, something's up. He's so, not just
or,
like
or is
super
it?
Controlled.
Like you're at the beginning, yeah. You're totally in the perspective of this girl. She doesn't know what's going on, and neither do
like
you.
Cloverfield Lane.
A little bit at the beginning, and then
you're not sure if it's an apocalypse or if he's insane or if he's a kidnapper.
But unlike that's Cloverfield fun. Lane, yeah. About 20 minutes in.
So hold on, spoilers, guys. I haven't seen it
yet. 20 minutes.
20 minutes, act? I think, is it's.
Do we call this first act?
Yeah, first act.
Into two?
First
I'm talking about a spoiler for Cloverfield Lane.
That's true.
End of the first act of Freaks.
She leaves the house. She manages to escape to find out that her dad's telling the truth. People want her dead.
Oh, interesting.
And you don't know why. Fun. So it goes from there.
And she doesn't know why.
And tonally, or maybe like genre-wise, where does it ultimately land?
We call it a sci-fi thriller because it really... Also, people are like, it changes genres. What genre is this?
Some people call it the kitchen sink of genre.
And you know, the crazy thing is like when you're writing a movie, or when at least when we were writing the movie, we didn't really even talk about what genre are we writing. We were just talking about this character and what she's going through and all the weird stuff that's happening.
It's a highly subjective movie. The whole movie is from her perspective. It's even shot from her height. So all the adults are like looking down over you and you're looking up their noses.
They hired a very short DP.
and it, you know, mini spoiler here. There's weird things that are happening to her. And even the sound design is what she's hearing and stuff like that. That may not be happening in the real world, but it's what she's hearing. Stuff like that.
So basically the genre changes as her emotions change.
Oh, cool. At the beginning, it's very much like a horror movie because she's terrified. But then by the end, there's a lot of bloodlust and revenge, and it feels like almost like a revenge thriller.
It goes, you know, it's you'll laugh, you'll cry, you'll scream, got everything.
And how did you guys come up with it?
It's inspired by a lot of different things.
It's like a totally original screenplay. Right?
Yeah. We wrote it. We were basically both directors. We were both separate directors. This is the first feature that we wrote
together. Toronto, right?
I'm from Vancouver.
I'm from LA.
Adam's from LA.
I've lived in LA for 20 years, but originally from Miami, Florida.
Oh, you're not Canadian at all?
I am not Canadian. Although I have recently, because I've been working in Vancouver so much the last 4 years, I just applied and got my permanent residency in Canada.
Wait, so how did you guys meet each other?
So we have a very unique origin story. We actually met on a reality television show as contestants.
No.
Was it The Lot?
It was On the Lot.
Yeah. Oh. 12 years ago, there was a show called On the Lot.
That, you guys must know Jarrett Lee Conway then.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. He's great.
I was texting with him today.
Was he on the show?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was on our podcast. We talked to him for 2 hours. He never mentioned
talk about The Lot. Yeah.
So basically,
12 years ago, there was a show called On the Lot.
Mark Burnett, they had American Idol at the time was the biggest thing on TV. And so Fox said, Steven and Mark Burnett said, let's do American Idol, but for film, where you make a different short every week, different genre. And every, you know, indie filmmaker in the world applied. There was like 12,000 filmmakers, and they kept narrowing it down. Adam and I,
which were, nowadays that number would be like 1.2 million.
Right. Well, it was also just when YouTube was getting started.
Just started.
So they were also like piggybacking that, like, ooh, all the YouTubers out there, like, find the next great filmmaker.
Right. There's like 35 YouTubers.
Yeah. And so Adam and I were in the top 50. We actually, in the audition episode of the top 50, they actually put us in the same hotel room. And we just started.
You shared rooms?
Oh, yeah. Right at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was kind of cool because unlike Project Greenlight, where they just make one movie, everyone's making all these shorts all the time. And so we ended up like collaborating a lot, help each other on our scripts.
It ended up being terrible television because reality television is all about everyone getting drunk and screaming at each other.
I'm not like, here to make friends.
And you get like 50 indie filmmakers together and everyone's just like, oh, that was so cool. Like, what editing software did you use? And, oh, I loved your script. And
especially
became really
because
boring.
It was like a vote from home thing. So the voters at home kicked off anyone who was a jerk really early because I don't like them. Gone.
Yeah. There's a TV show without a villain.
And so now like there was like 10 of us by the last 10 who all just loved each other and just like hung out all the time.
So it was really boring, but we became close friends and best friends. And from then after that, I moved to LA and we directed separately for a while and started doing little shorts.
What place did you guys come in on the lot?
Adam came in third. And I came in fifth, so he's two better of a filmmaker than me.
Can you tell us what you learned from your worst films?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, I can tell you.
I definitely had some bad ones.
I went through sort of a mini career in like 1 month, which is like I started off full of just excitement and imagination and made some incredible first few things. And then it's weird to think of, but like you're in quarantine on a reality show, so you have zero access to the world. You get monitored phone calls once a week.
Can you use the internet? No internet
access, no reading, no pens and papers, nothing.
You can't pick up a magazine?
Well, no. The pens and papers they give us.
Well, you can't because they didn't want you to get an idea from a magazine that someone else didn't have access to. So it was all about being basically isolated.
It was about fairness. So they would take us to the video store and let us rent videos. This was back in the day when you could rent videos, boys and girls. And they would do stuff like that, but they wouldn't let us communicate with anyone because they didn't want me calling you and saying, hey, what do you think about this idea?
So through my films, they started getting more and more sort of derivative and sort of unoriginal because you're being forced to perform and output a new brilliant idea every week with like just sort of like just the pieces that are thrown at you. And by the end, my last one was pretty unoriginal. And it was just like a crappy sequel to a movie I'd made the week before, which was not that original either. And I got just like called out on it and kicked off.
And the contestants.
So I had like
writing
the career of directors that like
I
have
think
these.
Was
like,
a, it, it became just as much a writing competition right. as sure. a directing right. competition. Sure, sure. So that was definitely a huge challenge. I sort of had a pandering problem. My worst couple of films were when I was trying to think, okay, what do people like? What, you know, what will they like? Okay.
Because you have a very specific audience that you're making these shorts for.
And instead of doing something I liked, I tried to guess at what people would like.
Yeah.
And that was
always a bad idea.
You know what else is just occurring to me is so funny about this? It's like, I'm thinking, oh, well, you know not to do these certain tactics or whatever, because we've all seen so many reality shows. You see what people fall, like pitfalls they make. But like you guys hadn't yet.
Right.
Right. Like it wasn't like you had this like decade or two of like, you know, vocabulary or just ideas of like how those shows are meant to work.
Well, it was
right?
funny.
And
I also
never watched reality shows.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Actually, the guy who won, Will, was a huge Survivor fan.
And was very
and so
aware.
He was very aware of all that
What's
stuff.
What's his last name?
Will Bingham.
Bingham.
He was very smart. But like in the first few days, Adam and I laugh about it now because we were so naive. But the interviewers would be like, so what makes you unique? What is your story? And we'd be like, I like making movies. And they're like, no, that's not good enough. Like, sure. Why should people care? If I don't make movies, I'll be sad. No, you need like, whereas like Will was like, I'm a father with two kids.
Yeah.
And then if I don't win this,
see,
I'm going to have to give up filmmaking forever.
Right.
And my two daughters, I'll have to go take a job to support my daughters. So everyone was just like voting for him like crazy. But he did that on purpose. Like he was very smart.
Of course. Yeah. He's a storyteller. Right?
Yeah. Exactly. He was a genius.
Exactly. Well, great guys.
What inception level are we at now?
That was on the lot. Should we move forward?
I think we can start moving forward. Yeah.
So after On the Lot,
So you guys decided to start working together.
Well, right? so we worked separately, and we kind of, we actually got agents for the first time after On the Lot, even though we couldn't get work.
Cause just, it was just to illustrate though, are you still with those agents?
I am.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
So my agent actually broke backstage through the quarantine and ran up to me and said, when you're off this thing, give me a call.
No
way. And I'm still with him. Now Adam's repped by
and
him too.
I am now with that agent as well.
Wow.
But yeah, so then we kind of just tried to get any work we could get. You know, we were just, and I got some commercial.
Wait, but were you teamed up at this point?
No. We were friends that basically just were supportive of each other.
Yeah.
And did you move to LA, Zach?
I moved for a little while. Like after a few years, I moved. I don't remember what the time was, but yeah, I moved here for about 4 or 5 years. And I was like 40 grand in debt, just lying on the floor, depressed. Couldn't get anything going. And then the lowest point was actually, there's this company that makes basically the worst type of movies you could ever make, just above porn. Like basically, they make like, I mean, their biggest hits are like Sharknado, but most of them are like, if Transformers is coming out, they release Transmorphers. Right, and right. So like
snakes on a train.
Should we say the name of the company?
Go for it.
The Asylum?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And so they called me up and I was so desperate. And they were like, you're that kid from On the Lot. Like, come and meet us. And I went out to their place in Burbank. And they met the guy, one of the guys running the place, met me on rollerblades. And it was like rollerblading around. And I'll never forget this. He's like, I am so sorry that you've ended up here. But I am so excited. Like, he was like, because you're a real filmmaker.
I mean, that's not such a bad attitude to have.
And he's like,
right?
We pay our DPs $20 a day. And you got 5 days to make the movie and blah, 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 blah. But like, you're going to get a chance to make a movie. And I was just like, oh my God, is this where we've ended up?
Yeah.
And then at the same time when I was delivering.
And were you responsible for the script as well?
I didn't actually end up making one there, but he was basically just like, yeah, here's 5 scripts we're making. Like, which one do you want to do? Like,
yeah, just
here's
go
the
for
poster
it.
Of yeah. it. Like, yeah, they already had the poster.
Are they still making?
Oh, yeah.
Movie?
They are still making movies, though. They did get sued after, I think Transmorphers is maybe the one. Because they had a big deal with, like, Hollywood Video, which I know because I was a clerk at Hollywood Video at the time. And they would, you know, it was a deal where, like, you know, those videos are all basically alphabetical. And so, like, you would put Transmorphers next to Transformers. And then, like, someone who was confused and was just, like, grabbing a video for their kids would rent the wrong thing.
Well, they told me their business...
High. And they got sued, basically.
Yeah, like, their business model was basically... Illegal. They would pre-sell the movie entirely before they made it, just on the poster. And so then any amount of money they spent from that point on was lost, because they'd already, any profit they were ever going to make had already been made before they made it.
Yeah.
So then it was just to make it for as little as possible, so that when someone took that poster by accident, there was something on the disc.
Yeah. Technically speaking, there's a movie on it. I actually had a friend who did a video or a movie for them not that long ago, and he was like, "Yeah, if you don't make your day, that's that. Like you just don't have that scene anymore. Yeah. Like that's the whole thing. So you put the most important stuff." At the top of the day, because if you don't get to the end,
that's actually not a bad advice in general.
Yeah,
I start with your most important stuff.
Yeah,
if you could,
we do that.
Go to OT because you want to spend more time on your most important stuff.
Sure, that is true.
So right around then, someone in Vancouver had remembered me, and they were making a low budget sci-fi monster movie for the Sci-Fi Channel, and
they remembered you from the show
Line. Yeah, and they. They were at the time, a lot of the usual guys were doing sci-fi monster movies, and they were like, let's shake it up. And this guy mentioned me, and they were going to pay me 40 grand, and I was 40 grand in debt. And I was like, and there was actually some cool elements to it.
Is this the Tasmanian Devil?
That was Tasmanian Devils, a movie about giant man-eating Tasmanian devils.
Regular listeners will recognize it from the Shotlister ad.
IO9 called it the best sci-fi monster movie ever made.
Oh, wow.
Well, Sci-Fi Channel.
Sci-fi Channel.
Oh, okay. Not sci-fi.
Exactly.
Like S-Y-F-Y.
It's definitely the best movie about Tasmanian devils.
Did you have to go to Tasmania?
No, we shot in Vancouver.
The Tasmania of Canada?
Yeah. I mean, Tasmania is pretty forested. It looks sort of similar. Canadian actors with really terrible Australian accents.
I mean, that is pretty charming.
But it has Winnie Cooper as the lead, who
we went to school together.
Yeah, she builds a flamethrower out of pieces of their broken Jeep and roasts, you know, giant Tasmanian devils. Anyway, so that that was my first movie, TV movie, which led to sort of my next movie and my third film, which were all sort of job for hire horror films as I was kind of working my way up. And at the meantime, Adam was doing Jimmy Kimmel and other.
Well, I was really, my bread and butter was doing like corporate videos and commercial, you know, any kind of like online commercials I could get while I was writing scripts. I wrote probably like 4 or 5 different scripts.
Features
that I had agents at this point, and I was trying to get these agents to, you know, sell the scripts. And then also I was going out on open directing assignment meetings and actually got hired on a couple movies to like, I just got hired on a movie. I'm directing a movie.
I did it, Ma.
My dream came true. Yeah.
And then
your parents said, we're never talking to you again.
We'll work for years on these movies that then never ended up getting made. And of course, you don't get paid as a director when you do that. You just go on meeting after meeting.
Well, work
with writers. And
one of them did get made just without you.
Right. That was the first one. The very first meeting I went on after I got my managers was for an open directing assignment at one of the mini Fox labels, Fox Atomic, which was like the youth-centered Fox label at the time. And it was right after Knocked Up and Superbad had come out, I think. And so they were trying to do a Judd Apatow, like,
rip-off.
You know, like teen comedy.
Yeah.
And was that kind of your thing as comedy?
I had made a lot of comedic shorts. And so that was like where my agents were trying to, you know, get me to do stuff.
Pigeonhole you. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
I mean, like,
which is okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or get hired.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
You know, yeah, I was up for anything.
As a pair of comedy directors, like, we get it.
You know, yeah. I was up for anything. And I was like, great, I'll do, let's go. It's a $15 million movie.
Sure. Yeah.
And I pitched and they loved my pitch and I went up the ladder and I pitched ahead of Fox.
How did you know how to pitch?
You know, it's really, I don't know.
Terrible pitching.
No, I just think like, it's just telling a story and with images, you know, I put a lot of images together. Like, this is the scene. This is what I want to do with the camera. And this is what I want to do with this character. And
it's something you slowly get better at. Each pitch, you kind of get better at pitching.
And this was working like gangbusters. I don't know what it was. I think they just wanted like a young person, you know, and they wanted to hire me. And then the writer's strike happened. And the producer on this was 1492, Chris Columbus's company. They were producing the movie for Fox. And because the writer's strike happened and Chris Columbus was making Percy Jackson at the time, and that movie was then going to be on hold, he said, oh, what's this little movie that's ready to go?
I'll just do that.
I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
So he ended up directing it.
Oh, and what was that called?
It was called I Love You, Beth Cooper.
Oh, I think I've heard it, of it.
I have heard of
Paul Russ starred in it.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah,
And that was the first movie I got fired from.
And then at the same time, there was a movie I was really trying to get made. And long story short, they fired me too because they didn't think I was a big enough director to get cast. And so both Adam and I...
And you had done like 3 movies at this point.
Right, but at this point, it was like a prestigious like indie movie that would finally show people like my true heart and craft.
Yeah.
Were you like trying to do more drama character?
It's not drama, but it was like, I mean, my love is sort of elevated sci-fi. So stuff like Moon or Ex Machina and that type of stuff. And so this was just a brilliant thing. It was written by the creator of Orphan Black and it was just this really cool thing. But then
he's Canadian.
Yeah. And they fired me. And just both Adam and I had just had all these experiences of like the stuff we really wanted to do.
I just told you guys about the first time I was fired. Sure. But basically the pattern.
Been through the ringer.
The pattern is, and I also did some digital series that were great. I didn't get fired. But the pattern is when you have no credits.
Sure.
I think producers and financiers are very worried about you. Because
you're untested.
You're untested.
Even, you've made all of these things and like been on a TV show, blah, blah, blah.
I had between Kimmel and film school and whatever, I've made over 200 shorts. Sure.
Yeah. But do you find that it's not really that they're worried about whether you can work with a big crew or you can make your days or you can make your budget? It's mostly about whether you can get amazing cast attached.
Yes. And that's
especially for indies.
It's like not a technical issue. I think there's a prestige issue.
There's also like a little bit of like, well, if they haven't done it yet, and my boss asks, hey, has this person done the thing we're hiring them to do yet? And you have to say no, you look like an asshole.
Well, I think it's most executives. The biggest thing I've noticed that's true of pretty much every executive, other than the really amazing ones, is their biggest concern is their job, not the film. As a filmmaker, your biggest concern is the film. Anything that makes the film incredible. This is just one of many films that they have. And their biggest concern is their boss and them moving up the ladder. And so they never want to stick their neck out in a way that will, the ramifications of failure will come towards them. So that's why there's always lots of movies based on pre-existing IP right. because, well, it's not my fault it failed. The book sold 1,000 copies.
But I do think that the actor attachment is the reason that both of us got fired from our
You got fired.
The latest thing we got fired from.
You got fired because you attached a bunch of casts. Yeah, and they said,
so
this cast sucks.
I was working on this film. The actors that I got attached, who were incredible actors and would have been a great movie with them, weren't big enough in their mind to make a $20 million movie financed.
Which
would have
is
been
the
an incredible
$2
million movie.
Right, yeah.
They would have been killer in it, in the $5 million version or below. But anyway, so they decided I was the problem. And so they got rid of me to try to hire a bigger director. Now, of course, as soon as they fired me, the project died and went back on the shelf.
Right.
And
they,
a lot of
they never hired another director.
But what part of what made it work was your ideas on tweaks and stuff. Right?
Yeah, the ideas are now in the ether and part of the script and whatever. Right. And you know, but also just the energy.
Let me ask you that.
Yeah, the passion, I think. Like,
yeah, you were the engine.
I was the driving force of it.
They just didn't realize that.
But I wasn't big enough to get an A-list star. That's also true.
Can I ask you this? Because I've heard it from many different directors, and it's exactly the situation where, and I think Matt and you and I have
been
in
the exact same position.
Where we meet writers, they have a script. We love it, but we have some ideas of some changes. We pitch it to them. We develop it together. They make the changes. The script is better. And then you basically get detached from it. Do you still...
Yeah.
Do you feel like
that is
you own some of that?
You don't technically. That's something that's a discussion I've had with my awesome lawyer, who's been my lawyer for 12 years. Unless it's papered before, it's really, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we basically just went movie after movie after movie.
And this is after you try to attach A-list actors and it doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, there's just like you try everything you can do. You can get the actor, but to get the actor, you need this. And to get that, you need this amount of money. But to get that money, you need this person. And just, it always falls apart, or at least it was for us every time we tried. So then we both came together. We were super frustrated. We were both desperate. We were like, we need to make something, and it's sort of relevant to your podcast's title, that we can make.
Just shoot it.
We just need to shoot something no matter what. Like, just that no one can stop us from making.
Well, I think that ultimately we were aiming too high for our first feature film.
Even though you had already directed like three movies.
Well, here's the thing. We watched, and it's very good advice, but you probably heard of it, the Mark Duplass speech that he gave at South by Southwest.
The Cavalry's
not coming. Yeah. And he gives very matter-of-fact advice that is kind of brilliant, but
you've probably talked about it before.
No, you know, we haven't
think
really
we
covered
have
it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, this.
Pause the podcast.
Pause the podcast.
Go
watch that video.
Yeah. Mark Duplass.
Pull your car over.
Not Mark Duplass. South by Southwest. Cavalry is not coming.
And he basically says, if you don't have $5 million, if you don't have $10 million, don't write a script that costs $5 million or $10 million. If you're nobody, like, write a script that you can actually make right now with just the stuff you have.
And make a list. What do you have right now? Well, you have this awesome dining room table. Maybe this is in the movie. You got a piano. That could be in the movie.
Is the movie about podcasters?
Yeah. And he literally said, my brother and I had a puffy chair and a van.
Sure.
And that was our first movie. And we had us. And we were in it.
And so we
were like, that's what we got to do.
But does he say, like, set up the movie and then if you can trade out things for better things to do?
Because the secret...
Not really. He just says, only use what you have.
Right.
Never wait to get something that you don't have.
And the refrain of the cavalry isn't coming is basically every time you're like, I did it. I made the no-budget movie and it got into these things. Finally, I think I'm going to...
I can do a $10 million movie.
Now, the cavalry isn't coming.
You're going
like,
to have
you,
to
still... You have to figure out how to make that $10 million movie yourself.
Before we get into the show, here's a word from our sponsor, MusicBed, and their owner, Daniel McCarthy.
Daniel, I'm curious, actually, because it sounds like you guys are so involved with the selection process of what you're listing on the site. Are there other services that you offer filmmakers who are trying to find that perfect track?
Yeah, so we actually have people on staff that will track down, search for music for you. Recommend using that service as much as possible. They're going to find stuff that you might not have found. Give them a brief, give them a scene description, give them a mood, give them a characteristic. I mean, heck, give them a color, give them something that just helps kind of process in their mind. What mood are you trying to accomplish here?
It's kind of like you have your very own record store nerd.
That's exactly what it is. And it is a group of people that know the catalog inside and out. I would say they'll help you kind of find the gold.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thanks again to MusicBed for sponsoring this episode of Just Shoot It. If you want to get a free month of a MusicBed subscription or 20% off your next single song license, head to musicbed.com and use the promo code JustShootIt, all one word. Thanks. Hey everyone, the biggest movie out right now that everyone is talking about is The Irishman. It's on Netflix. It's a Scorsese flick. It's got De Niro, it's got Pacino, it's got Pesci, it's got all sorts of amazing visual effects. And we wanted to tell you about a podcast that is basically the Just Shoot It podcast of The Irishman.
Yeah, it's the official three-part companion podcast from Netflix. The show is called Behind The Irishman. It's hosted by co-star and comedian Sebastian Maniscalco.
They go behind the scenes on costuming, on how they achieved the effects. Really a super deep dive into that movie.
It's conversations with De Niro and Scorsese about like how long it took them to actually make this movie possible, and also how they got Joe Pesci out of retirement.
Yeah.
Home Alone 15 wasn't good enough.
Please watch the movie. It's on Netflix right now before you listen to this podcast, because there's a ton of spoilers. The first episode's already out, and there's new episodes coming out every Monday. And this is just one of a ton of podcasts that Netflix is producing for various shows. They did one for Stranger Things. There's one coming out right now for The Crown. And this is actually their first one that's dedicated to a single film.
Yeah, so if you want to check it out, search for Behind the Irishman on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts.
So let's incept this back here.
That's so good, you guys.
This is 5 years ago.
Yeah.
We had just both been basically fired. We said, we got to make a movie. What do we have? Let's make a list. Duplass inspired us. We're going to write this. And the first draft of the script was for us to be in it. It was about a dad and a son and an uncle. Mm-hmm. And
Zach being the
and,
uncle.
And, you know, it takes place, you know, half inside a house. And we wrote the first draft of the script that way. And then once we started revising the script and and people started saying, you know, that's pretty good. You know what? I always wanted to invest in a movie. I'd give you guys 10 grand maybe. Mm-hmm. And we said, oh shit, okay, we have 10 grand.
Wait, who are these people?
So
old friends.
Like friends of yours, not Hollywood people.
Yeah, friends. No.
Old friends.
The first investors, one was Adam's uncle, who loved film but knew nothing about it. He was a chemical engineer.
Well, he's always been a movie lover, but he's a chemical engineer.
Right. And like a real nerd.
One of my oldest friends was a filmmaker. He made a first film and went so broke that he was living in a warehouse with no heat and stealing toilet paper from house parties. And then eventually...
Not a bad idea.
But he went from that warehouse and became a furniture mogul.
And then started selling couches, learning the job, things in the warehouse, and became a millionaire selling couches and patio furniture. And so people like
that.
One
of the most comfortable guys in America.
So that guy who always wanted to make another movie is like, I'll give you a little bit of money because this is a good concept.
And are you guys soliciting these people, or is it literally, it's just
sort of. Hey, what are you doing? Like, hey, Rick, who's Zach's old friend, you know, that we're working on this thing and, you know, we might someday need to raise money.
But we also did one of the things we did a huge amount was doing script readings. So we'd have a bunch of actors read the script and have friends come over to give us notes.
Like a table read.
Yeah. We did that like 5 or 6 times. And each time.
And just friends that are actors, not like, not people that.
Oh, yeah. We would just order some pizza and people would come over.
And can I ask why, if you have friends that are actors, why cast yourselves from the beginning?
Because who knew
we
if they
literally
were
said
shoot a film on weekends for 6 months.
Like, are you gonna, you know, would they do it for $0? Because at that point, it was still the $0 plan.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
I mean, the funny thing is, if you send someone
we always thought, okay, we could probably find an actor to do these roles for $0.
But the backup
is that we will do it. Yeah. So that we are making this movie. So
there's no reason.
It was the attitude of we are making this movie no matter what.
If every old lady in the world says they're not doing the movie, then we'd be screwed. So if we write it with things we already have, we can always make it no matter what. So that was the key. The thing I was going to say earlier is when you send someone a script, they never read it.
Sure.
But if you say, come over to my house and listen to the script and I'll have pizza and then we'll talk about it, it'll take way more of your time, but it'll be social. Tons of people will gladly do that.
Well, it depends on how quickly you fall asleep while reading.
So we did the first script reading and we got so much useful feedback because the first draft was terrible. Mm-hmm. And
was it just, do you invite just people to to read roles or also additional people
additional,
to just listen
an audience.
To?
Oh,
yeah. Audience, too. Yeah.
Just of like 5 or 6
And people. It was very educational. And we were like, oh, my God, now we know what to do in the rewrite. And we totally rewrote it. And then we were like, we got to do another reading because last time it was so helpful. And we ended up doing it again and again and again. And once you do that 5 times and you really, really rewrite it for 2 months in between those readings, script can get pretty good. And then we had a script that was actually, when we were showing it to our managers or our agents or whatever, they're like, you guys, this script's pretty good. Like, I think
Are you changing like the ending and the twists and
every detail?
Everything. There are huge sections that changed, whole sequences that went out. And
one of the early
changed
things
to a girl instead of a boy because we like that better.
Especially the movie's it's a mystery. And so as a writer of a mystery, you know all the answers, but you really need to make sure the audience is picking up each detail along the way in a satisfying way. So it's really hard to write that without feedback. But one of the things that happened early on was we got enough money. Basically, casting directors generally always cost $10,000 for indie movies. So we got $10,000. So we're like, okay, let's hire a casting director and see if now we've got this script that people say is good. Let's just start sending it to people.
Can we attach some people?
Well, first of all, we knew we needed a really good kid to play the lead. At that point,
it was still a 5-year-old.
At that point, it was a girl. We were flexible in the age. We actually aged it up a little bit. As my son got older, I was like, we should make this older.
You're like pretty good at stuff now, finally.
And so the character is 7 in the movie. But we knew, okay, we've just written a script where there's a 7-year-old in every scene and not just being like a passive, wise observer or a cute, you know, kid. This is like a fierce, crying, screaming, like passion role.
Yeah.
We need to kill our kid in this. And why did we write this? We're stupid. We can't make this movie now.
You are approaching a movie with like, how can we make something that's totally shootable?
Well, your son
like,
was
a,
that
a
way.
Lead kid,
you know what?
Is a little
my
tricky,
son
right?
inspired the role. He is a fierce, passionate, like super big emotions kid. And so,
except when you say action,
part of the idea of telling the story from the kid's point of view that you can put the camera, shoot things from the kid's point of view, and you don't need the kid in that.
Yeah, we did.
No.
I mean, there are
point
of view
shots.
It's
not like a point of view movie.
Yeah.
No, it's not a point of view movie. It's more that like we loved. This is what creatively we've talked a lot about the business side of things. What creatively inspired the story is watching how my son started to try to understand the world in those years when you're 5, 6, 7, wake up terrified from a nightmare and have to try to kind of slowly understand that that wasn't real. But then he's running out into the street and you're terrified.
Sure.
And he's like, what's the big deal? Why is my parent terrified?
Right.
And so that it was so fascinating to watch a kid start to put the pieces, puzzle pieces of understanding the world together.
Kids like dinosaurs so much, right? Because it's
they're
like,
real, but they're
real, but it's so confusing, right?
Yeah. And so, so we were fascinated by how kids start to understand the world. And the kind of light bulb moment for us being sci-fi fans was, what if the world was a sci-fi world?
So you don't know what it is.
You don't know. As the audience, if you're in the kid's perspective, you don't know what's real and what isn't in this world. You know what's real and what isn't in your own world, but this world is not your world.
And when you say sci-fi world, do you mean that it's not on Earth?
You'll have to watch to find out.
Today,
when the movie starts, you have zero clue. You can't see outside, so you have no idea.
It doesn't play by the rules.
But what
does
the trailer show us?
That's what it means.
The trailer is
it's pretty obscure.
The distributor did an amazing job setting up the kid and trapped in a house by her father. Their mom is dead, but she wants to find out what happened to the mom. And there's lots of crazy shit happening.
And freaks like are dangerous, and freaks are out there, and freaks are something that we should be scared of.
And
what does that mean?
And so, but telling the story, the whole narrative structure of the story is told from her perspective, and you're finding out things as she's finding them out. And sometimes she's really terrified and confused, and you're really terrified and confused. But you don't know if you can trust what he's telling you, because you look out the window. She kind of steals glances out the window, and it's different than you expected. So it's all unfolds from her perspective.
And so there's never a moment where the audience of adults is aware of a sense of danger that the child
is. Well, there is in some ways that are fun because there's moments where basically
she's walking into a situation that she thinks seems fine. For example, the first time she meets Bruce Dern. But he, just because of who he is, and he's basically this ice cream man who's trying to lure her out of the house with ice cream.
There's an ice cream truck.
She wants ice cream. This is great news. There's Bruce Dern giving me ice cream.
Sure.
But you were like, stay away from that man. Stay away from that man.
He's learned not, enough to know that it's not okay to go get ice cream.
Or is it? Or is it? Any preconceptions the audience had, we wanted to play with. So the fact that there's an ice cream truck driving around her house, playing this creepy music with Bruce Dern staring at the window, trying to kind of coax her to come outside, to her, that's awesome. She wants ice cream.
Sure. Yeah.
But to you, you're like, don't go out there, don't go out there. But at the same time, then we always tried to flip it. Like, wait a second, maybe he is a good guy. Maybe the dad's a bad guy. Oh, wait, you don't know. So that's kind of what the movie's about.
And so it's a really fun read. We started sending it to actors. We got some letters back from a lot of the first actors we sent it to that were like, this is an incredible script, but there's no way you can make this movie for nothing. Like, it's impossible.
Well, at this point, so you still only had the 10 grand for the casting director.
What was exciting was we had this casting director
I feel like a lot of this piece of advice we give on the podcast all the time that you guys are kind of negating is that, like, just having a casting director does not do much to attach names to your movie. That's what our
we had
soft interest. Mm-hmm. We had 10 grand in the bank, so we could actually pay a casting director. But some of these other people we talked to,
other actors, you mean?
No, other kind of rich investor types.
I see.
We're like, you know what? This script is really good, you guys. This script is really good. Who's going to be in it? Well, we don't know. It might be no names. It might be us. Well, you know, I might be interested. I might be interested. Keep me posted. We had 4 or 5 people who were like that.
High net worth individuals.
Yeah. So we knew
the script was like reading well, but and we knew if we could get someone, then they would come in. But if we didn't, then maybe they wouldn't come in, but it was still okay because we could still make it with us for nothing.
Wait, but when you're sending it to actors, is there an offer attached?
Yeah. We basically just offered the minimum, which you're allowed to, which is Schedule F, which is basically...
That's not the minimum, Zach. That's actually pretty nice for an indie film.
It's a minimum for a flat, which is basically we can use you as much as we need you.
For how much money?
It's $65,000.
For any number of days?
Well, you put in the letter, you put, we're offering SAG Schedule F for 17 days of filming.
Oh, okay. Whatever it is you think you need them for.
Without dates.
Yeah,
without,
and that sort of covers overtime, like every, basically you are ours for that amount of time.
For those 17 days.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Did you know that?
I hadn't heard that actually.
Instead of paying a day rate. Yeah.
It's the lowest flat rate SAG offers.
Interesting. Oh. But you're not on the hook unless the movie's a go, basically.
Well, we would basically... knew if any of them said yes, we could get 65 grand, so that wasn't a problem.
I see.
So we were just...
Well, we knew if any of the people we were offering it to said yes.
Right.
It wasn't just we had 65 grand. The kinds of people we were offering it to, we actually talked to some of these soft investors and say, hey, what do you think about Bruce Dern?
Right.
Oh, he's amazing. Is he in? No, but we're going to send him a letter now. And but, if he comes in, are you going to be in? I think I could do that, you know? It was kind of a rolling series of conversations.
Right, sure.
And it did grow. Like, the movie wasn't made for $0. We can't say exactly how much it was.
Obviously,
we
got Bruce Dern, so yeah, it's more than 65.
We afforded a couple of Schedule F's, and then we afforded some production.
And crew and stuff. But we were still... We shot it in Vancouver, in my hometown,
but
calling out a lot of favors.
I guess what we're trying to communicate is, like, we didn't count. See, every project we'd been involved in, if you can't get those actors attached, the movie's dead. And we always had the backup plan.
So we actually ended up drawing a line in the sand. Because we have a kid in every scene of the movie, that basically means you have to shoot in the summer because they don't have to do schooling. So you get 3 extra hours a day of shooting with them. So we knew we were shooting in the summer.
You hadn't done the Disney stuff at this point.
We've done some. It was kind of at the same time, which is an interesting topic in itself. But basically, in between doing the pilot, and I was like, okay, well, I don't know if that's ever going to go. Adam and I were finishing Freaks. We're like, let's see if we can actually make...
We were writing Freaks.
But we thought... Because then Mechix 4 got...
We had just finished basically the second draft of Freaks. And he got the job to direct the pilot.
And Mech Explorer.
And I was like, what the fuck? Sorry, can I curse on this? Yeah, yeah. What the fuck? We're supposed to make this movie.
Like, dude, like, and, my kid's like, going to get older.
Maybe yeah. we can make it before I shoot the pilot. And the script just wasn't ready. Yeah, and we yeah. weren't ready.
No, it like, wasn't no. even the pilot, Adam. It was between the pilot. Like, the pilot only took like a month or something.
Right, right, right.
The show got picked up. And they asked me to be the producing director, basically, wow. for the whole first season. So then they greenlight the show. And I'm the producing director, which means I kind of oversee all the directors on the show. I'm sort of the showrunner of the directors. And I said, which means that for the episodes I'm directing, I'm not in prep on whichever the next episode is happening. So I said, if you want another one of me, the only director I can't supervise is whoever's prepping while I'm shooting. So there's this other guy who's done lots of Jimmy Kimmel. He's done all this cool stuff. You got to hire him.
I got a buddy.
Yeah. And
Harvard.
And yeah. they basically, we'll give him an episode, I guess. Like, it was sort of like a test because I hadn't done it. So Adam did episodes 3 and 4. I did episode 1 and 2. And then 3 and 4 went really well. And then they just started rolling us through. And then they ended up doing 2 seasons. So between the pilot and the first season, we actually thought we were going to shoot Freaks. We were trying to race it in before the first season started. And then we just realized we just weren't ready. There just wasn't enough time. So we ended up shooting.
And then we said, well, after season one, we'll shoot Freaks.
But then
so
what
we
happened?
We were still revising the script while we were directing Freaks, directing Mech Explorer.
Then the tax credits in Vancouver changed. And there was basically like all this reasons that they basically did season 1 and 2 back to back. So we ended up shooting for like 2 years. Because
and you're like living in Vancouver at this point. Right.
Well, Adam. That's the thing. Like I have 2 kids at this point. and I am in Vancouver for more of the year than I'm in LA.
Right.
Which is why I applied for residency.
And so by the time the second season was coming, was finishing, we're like, we're going to shoot the movie no matter what before the third season starts. So we just kind of drew a line in the sand. We're shooting it this summer. We're going to make it. And we started just pulling all the triggers that couldn't be unpulled. Like, okay, we're booking an actor for that time. We're going to be telling, you know, all that gear, we need it this day.
Hold on. Yeah. Financing though, right? Yeah. Like you guys are pulling these triggers. Are those down payments coming out of your pocket or is it
so
your,
this,
these high net worth
the good,
individuals?
The good thing is doing 2 seasons of TV as a director, we actually did have some money saved up.
Yeah.
So beyond the 10 grand we got from our buddy for our first investor, we actually decided, okay, we're getting such good response on the script. We can probably hire real actors, even if they're no names. We're going to put in some of our own money. Now, we had some savings. We're going to each put in, I think we ended up each putting in, you know, 50 grand to start that we had saved. And so now we have 110. That's like an actual movie.
Yeah, sure. You can make a movie for that much
money.
That's
a tenth of an episode of
and then because we were putting in our own money, some of those investors who we'd been talking to were like, wait, you guys are investing?
And you're shooting on August 3rd?
And you know what? Right. You know what? I that means a lot to me. I'm going to give you some money. So
The ball started rolling and the budget basically started going up. We knew at each level we could make it with whatever we had, but it started kind of going bigger.
And we had
bigger
some investors that we talked to, either through our managers or whatever, who were kind of the more traditional investors, who we ended up saying no to. Because there were too many strings attached. And we saw the strings tying us up.
I don't want to cast your niece.
It wasn't going to. No, it'd be like, we'll give you 400 grand. But there's
one company who said they would give us 250 grand.
Only if it goes to like an A-list superstar.
Right.
Like, our money will be used to finance an offer to an A-list star.
But this was like
delaying the project.
Whoa, this was like, this was 3 weeks before we started shooting.
Yeah, sure.
We're like, there's no way we're going to get someone in 3 weeks. So we'd have to delay and then it probably won't happen and then we'll be screwed. So
there was another investor who by this point we'd built confidence in our movie because when we sent it to these agents, we got good responses. Like usually agents don't even call you back. Yeah, sure. But we had one agent at UTA who called us out of nowhere and said, "You guys, this is the best script I've read this year." We're like, I mean, fuck yeah. Awesome.
You're like,
he's
like, I know.
I'm putting my clients into this movie. This movie's going to be good. I'm putting my clients into this movie. We're like, bring it on.
Wait, where was this agent from?
Brian Nosikoff at UTA, who represents Amanda Crew.
Oh, yeah.
Who ended up being in the movie. And she is amazing.
She's like one of those actors where you see her in Silicon Valley and you're like, oh.
Well, that's why she was begging to do this role, because she's known as being a pretty funny girl. Mm-hmm. But in this movie, she's like
covered in blood, crying, she's like, you know, kick ass, you know, action star.
Yeah, yeah.
And she wanted to do it. She's dying to do it. And we were like, yeah, awesome.
We're like, this is going to be low budget, you know, like, and she's like, guys, my last movie, I was changing clothes in the gas station. She's like, yeah, I'll do whatever it takes to yeah, make this yeah. happen.
And actually, the first actor who responded from all our letters that we were sending into the void, we got someone who said, love the script, but I'm not going to do a tiny budget movie.
In Canada.
But the first one who said, I want to do it was Bruce Dern. Who we suddenly got a call from our casting director, and she was like, guys, Bruce Dern wants to do it. We're like,
and
what?
Did you meet with him or talk to him or anything?
We did
before
meet
he
with
said
him.
Yes?
Well, he basically said yes, and then we were like, can we meet with him to make sure he's right? Well, and we ended up having this lunch with him.
It's Bruce Dern. Right?
Yeah. Well, we wanted to make sure, like.
So what actually happened, just to give the Just Shoot It listeners the real scoop,
the real, yeah.
Not the polish.
Bruce is very much about, like, he's been around, right? He's been acting for 65 years at this point. He's gotten lots of offers. And when he gets offered something for a low budget movie, they want to make sure there's cash on the barrel, that this is real, that's not just a project that's going to disappear.
Not escrow either.
Like, so the way his reps work it is, Bruce wants to do the movie. I want a signed contract by the end of this week saying that you're paying him this amount and you're going to send us this amount, and that's how we know you're serious.
Yeah.
And so we were like,
that's cool.
Holy shit. Okay. This just got really real, you guys. Now we actually have to send, you know, $65,000 at the end of this week. Like, this is real. But hopefully, there was also this feeling of like, well, we're just sending this money without ever talking to him. Like, that doesn't feel right either.
Is he going to phone it in? Is he going to love it? Is he like it? What does he think?
We kind of stood up for ourselves, because at this point, we knew people thought the script was good and we knew what we wanted out of this role. So we said, you know, we love him. We want him to do it. We have the money, because that was true. But we want to meet him. We want to make sure he's really passionate about this role, because this is our baby. We've been working on this for 4 years at this point. And we want to make sure that he feels passionately about this role, like we feel passionately about the movie.
And they said no. They said, okay, well, I guess it's not going to work out then. And for about an hour, we were like, well, I guess we just screwed it.
We were like, did we make the right decision? Well, I don't want to just send the money just if it's just a money job.
And then the phone rings. Right. Hello? Hello? It's Bruce. Hey, you doing the freaks?
And it was just like, I heard you want to talk to me. What's the problem? What, you don't think I can do this
role?
You
don't think I want to make this movie? Like, what's your issue? Like,
that's,
it was
so
like,
good.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Bruce. And we talked to him, and he told crazy stories, and then we sent the money, and then we had a lunch with him. And the lunch lasted almost 7 hours, like six and a half hours.
Art's Deli on that's Ventura.
Like a, wait, lunch dinner. A different deli?
Yeah.
He chose the place.
He chose
again,
the deli.
Something convenient for him.
Yeah, we didn't tell, like, Adam's, you know, family.
Art's Deli at noon. Meet Bruce. And
we had simple questions like, not only, can you drive? Like, because there's driving in the movie. Like, how long of a work day can you do? But he just sat down and just started
Have you ever worked
us,
with a kid before? You know?
And he just told us all of the stories of his entire, you know, he's worked with Hitchcock. He's worked with, you know, Kazan. He's worked with just like everyone.
He told
all
us about the time that Hitchcock hid from Spielberg because
he was embarrassed that he did
the voice for Universal Studios.
For the Jaws ride.
Spielberg made him feel cheap.
like all this crazy stuff. And it was insane because he's staring at you with those eyes pointing at your face for 6 hours, not stop talking.
And it ended when I said, Bruce, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just really, really have to pee. Because we literally hadn't gotten up.
Yeah.
He hadn't interrupted him for 6 hours.
Oh, yeah. Well, I got to pee too. I'll tell you. You know, let's go to the bathroom and I'll tell you. You know, the last time that I had to pee, it was in 1936. And just like, it was just pretty incredible. We had him. And once we had him, that helped
Amanda had already been talking to us. So we had him and we had Amanda. And in the meantime, we had started auditioning for the little girl, which was a huge another deal for time for another podcast probably. But we found this amazing actress. Everyone who comes to see the movie, you know, they come because the story looks interesting, or they come for Bruce or Emile Hirsch, who ended up in the movie. But everyone who sees the movie only comes out talking about her.
Because interesting. Sure.
It's that kind of thing, like Natalie Portman in The Professional, mm-hmm. or Drew Barrymore when she was young, that you just know, holy shit, I just saw the next superstar.
Yeah.
And did you tell that, you saw that immediately when she came into the room?
We auditioned in a very different way because we had all this experience working with kids. We knew how to work with kids.
Right.
But also we knew that we wanted a different kind of kid performance in this role that wasn't a Disney performance.
A lot of kids, deep. when they're in stuff, they're very robotic and sort of fake. And a lot of that is because they come super duper rehearsed because they want to make sure their parents make sure they know their lines, mm-hmm. and don't mess up a word.
Smile very, when you say this.
And they're basically super robots. Yeah. They're saying the words.
Which works for Mech X4.
We had a lot of experience getting the kids out of that on Mech X4. The kids on Mech X4, we used a lot of improv. And we used a lot of like stuff from their own lives to connect it, to make it more real than Disney had been used to doing. But with Freaks, we wanted to go to that to the nth degree and find a kid who was very raw, basically. And so in the auditions, we were sitting on the floor with coloring books with our shoes off. And we had the kids come in and say, you know, just put the, no, no script, just sit, color with us. You know, when that time, have you ever been mad at your parents? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, tell us about a time you were mad at your parents. Oh, well, he wouldn't let me go to sleep over. You know what? Let's improvise that scene. Let's just pretend we're doing that scene. And so we try to get these kids to their real emotions.
And you would play like the dad?
We had an actor who had come, and he basically would, whatever they had said the argument was about,
would improvise it.
So they were connecting to something that actually happened in their life. And then he would start saying lines from the actual scene.
The really good ones, like Lexi,
who's in the movie, she would, you know, say it was arguing about sleepovers. The actual scene was arguing about ice cream. The really amazing ones would
use the amazing kids and immediately go over and try to get them there emotionally first with their real life and then weave in the script.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. That's such an interesting way to like break kids into like.
And then Lexi in her audition, you know, her eyes were watering and her nostrils were flaring. She was spitting on us because she was so full of rage, you know. And we were just like, our hair was blown back like in those 80s commercials. And the crazy thing was there were a couple other actors, young actors, who could get there emotionally. But when we stopped them, you could tell they were rattled by the experience, mm-hmm. that they were kind of disturbed by what they had just done.
Yeah, they went there, but they're
they don't have the training to understand
the experience.
Exactly,
yeah.
And we didn't want that because we knew this would be a month of shooting and we didn't want to scar somebody.
But when we said cut the first time with her, she immediately just put her hand on the hip and was like, that was really good, guys. Oh, man, you're such a great actor to the guy we had there. This is so much fun. Oh, I loved your guys' lookbook. Like, she was just like immediately back to
being
funny.
And it was shocking.
Had she done a lot of acting before?
A little bit.
She'd been in a couple shows.
Cute girl making cookies and like.
And her older sister had done a lot of acting. So she kind of grew up watching her older sister and stuff.
Yeah. So the funny thing that happened, we finally had the cast. We had the money. We'd put a line in the sand. We had to get this done before Mech X4 went to season 3, and then they canceled Mech X4. And so we were like, okay, that means suddenly we've got all this runway. And then we're like, what are you doing with all this stuff? And so we basically went and stole
Mech X4.
Well, so Mech X4 had 2 seasons worth of this 100 square foot soundstage full of 100,000 square foot soundstage. And we went and took all the sets, all the props, all the, like, literally.
They were just trashing it. That's what happened.
The ice cream truck in the movie is the food truck from Mech X4. And we just took it all for free because I was a producer on the show. They were just like, yeah, take whatever you want. Yeah, and like, we basically
literally garbage.
Yeah.
Right.
They're just going to throw it all out. And we, you know, almost everything you see in the movie is stolen from that show.
Costumes.
And that was shooting in Vancouver.
So and then the other. Convenient.
But it was the craziest thing because they had already turned off the power on the soundstage. So we, with our like ragtag Bad News Bears crew of like unpaid, you know, people, open the bay doors of this soundstage with flashlights
warehouse,
and we're going
you got
through
the U-Haul picked up that exactly. morning.
Totally, yes, that's so actually very true. And the other crazy thing that happened, which is sort of an interesting lesson, because people often have this choice when you're a director between doing the work for hire or doing your passion project. And people often think you have to basically be one or the other. And I've definitely met filmmakers that only ever struggle and only do their passion projects, and filmmakers that only ever basically take the jobs and, you know, are labeled sellouts, maybe, but they're often they're creatively sort of empty, and then often the people that just do the passion projects are struggling and poor and can't make it happen.
We were lucky enough to have a day job and keep nurturing our passion project, and then they just gelled and matched, and we used
in all sorts
the favors from the TV
like
show.
Like the camera crew from MechX4, who own, you know, Red Scarlets and all this stuff because they make lots of money on union shows, were like, oh, I'll give you my camera gear for free for a month because while we're between seasons.
Sure.
And the visual effects houses.
On the next one.
Yeah, right, visual effects house that did all the robots, who makes, you know, $1 million an episode on whatever, they're like, yeah, well, we'll do 5 or 6 of the cool big visual effects for free. We love you guys. Like, and so all of the resources of MechX4 kind of in kind of free sort of favory kind of way went into the movie. And then vice versa, the movie being something we wrote and directed that was a passion project that was something we had created led to us doing a big movie like Kim Possible, which was 10 times the budget, even more. But because we had written and directed this movie and kind of proven ourselves as co-directors, it was that passion project that got us the much bigger studio thing.
Interesting.
Wait, so you did Freaks first and then Kim Possible.
Right. Well, we shot Freaks first, but while we were still editing Freaks, we got the job on Kim Possible. So it wasn't done. But we showed them a rough cut.
Oh, okay.
Because they had never worked with co-directors before. They thought that basically one scene would look like it was directed by one person and the other scene. And so they didn't think that two people could direct. So we showed them the movie and the movie was good. And they basically, it helped us get this much bigger Disney
project. But we were still editing and finishing it while we were prepping Kim Possible. And it took us basically a whole year to do post on Freaks.
The advice I give is that actually doing your passion projects, pushing them forward as much as you can, but also take the jobs that you can get. And there'll always be breaks where then
still survive.
And do both, because they end up ricocheting off each other and making both.
You meet people on the day jobs that can help you on your passion project.
Yeah.
And you save money on you make money on the day
so
jobs.
So your passion projects get bigger and better, while at the same time your day jobs get bigger and better because your passion projects
are
bigger. Yeah. Like your passion projects get more prestige, so you end up getting better day job things, and it goes back and forth.
I mean, that's the catch-22, right? It's like the day jobs only are as good as your passion projects, right? Like no one ever gets hired to do something.
Just as another example, we directed Kim Possible. We didn't write it because it was already a pre-existing thing. But then we've now sold an idea to Universal to write and direct to a big studio. And the only reason they think we can write and direct is because we did Freaks, even though it was a tiny movie. Mm-hmm. But because we did a studio thing, they think, oh, you're a studio person and you wrote and direct this tiny movie. So you combine those.
And you're these like TIFF filmmakers also.
Yeah, but without Kim Possible, that sale to Universal doesn't happen. But without Freaks, that sale to Universal doesn't happen. So they kind of combine.
I think if I were the big studio stuff that now we're lucky to get into the room for, I remember, you know, well, a year ago, that was unattainable for us as well. And I think the part that I didn't hear a lot about that I think could be interesting for your listeners was how to finish and sell a movie. Mm-hmm. Because we made Freaks, we actually went a little bit over budget and we had to like borrow money from Zach's mom's line of credit to like pay bills and stuff. And raise finishing funds, which was really we're over budget funds, and beg more favors from VFX houses to finish it. And then what do we do? Like we've just spent all this money from all these people. How do we make this money back? And how do we get the movie sold?
You guys are both equally in for $50K ahead.
Well, at this point, I think like we had any money we could find, we put into the movie.
Yeah,
and so we were in it. You know, our relatives, our best friends were in it. You know, it was pretty intense.
I mean,
the stress of finishing the movie, even though, and then while we were editing it, we were doing constant test screenings, just like we did with the stage readings. We did constant test screenings to keep improving the edit again and again, almost every weekend. The movie was getting kind of good, but we still thought, oh shit, what do we do?
Sure.
And so we eventually found these sales agents, basically, you know, through our agents and managers and stuff, started getting the rough cut in front of these things called sales agents, these people called sales agents, who are the people who specialize in taking independent films and finding buyers for them.
It's sort of like a real estate agent, but for your movie. Like they're specialized in getting the people that buy movies to see your thing.
To see your movie.
And negotiate the deal and try and get it sold.
And at this point, are you like trying to pre-sell like foreign rights?
No, thing that was unique that ended up being a big strength was we hadn't done any pre-sales at all to fund the movie. And that's generally, if you can, that's good because you always get way less when you pre-sell a territory than you would if you sell it once you have a movie.
Assuming that it premieres at TIFF or something like that, right? You know, like
to a degree.
There is the... If the movie wasn't good and didn't have
you have to believe in your movie. I mean, if the movie doesn't end up being good, then yeah, you would have gotten more by pre-selling it.
Sure.
But like one thing,
like the guys doing Transmorphers,
but one thing that's a factor now is that there are buyers who also only will buy your movie if it's global.
Oh, interesting. Like they just want a global
like Netflix, for instance.
Yeah. It's called a worldwide sale. So if no other territory has been sold in the world, then Netflix can be a Netflix original everywhere. But if you've already sold Germany, Canada, Spain, and Japan,
they don't want to slice it.
So that was something that all the sales agents were really excited by. It was like, ooh, we've got a worldwide sale here. Ooh.
And it has a global appeal
too. Right. We got rejected by lots of festivals and then got into TIFF.
Which is one of the best festivals.
And I emailed a friend of mine. I was just straight up. He had been in TIFF the previous year. And I was like, dude, how do you get into a film festival? Like, we're running out of options here. Like, and he said, oh, well, you just contact the programmers. No one ever reaches out to them, but they're really friendly. Here's the email of the TIFF programmer who I got to know last year.
I had always had this impression of festival programmers as these like mean, stern, like gatekeepers.
They get a billion emails a day.
Yeah, that hate
hearing from filmmakers.
I do love the idea that a programmer would hate movies.
Well, not that they hate movies, but they're like very judgmental,
very
hard to please, and just like kind of tough.
They have to be bribed or, you know, whatever. Yeah. And then I just emailed the guy. An hour later, he emailed me back. He's like, oh, I'd love to see your movie.
Yeah.
Thanks for reaching out.
You're
and
you're a nerd who watches 600 movies a year. Of course
you
love movies.
Some of the nicest people I have ever met in the film industry.
And they love movies and they love filmmakers and they love supporting. Luckily, they liked the movie. I mean, he said that when he watched it, we rented a theater for him to watch it in. He stood up when the credits roll and just said, I can program that movie. And a few weeks later, we were in. And suddenly you're kind of barreling towards, okay, we've got to get our movie to this. Because the reason you go to a big film festival, hopefully, is because they have certain ones have markets. Like smaller film festivals don't necessarily have markets, which means all that
buyers
means,
don't come.
It just means people that buy movies aren't going there to buy movies. And so we ended up getting a really amazing sales agent, which was CAA, to come on board the film.
CAA and Gersh.
And Gersh. And then the funny thing is, usually at a film festival, you're like, we've got to sell the theater. We've got to have as much buzz going around it. But really what you're trying to do is get the 10 or 15 people that buy movies to see your movie. Like, of all the movies, you want the room to also be full, and you want there to be buzz. But really, you're just trying to get those 15 people to see it.
And Toronto is very challenging because there's a lot of movies there with big, big stars. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot, just more movies there. More than Sundance, more than South By. It programs like 300-something movies. So it's very hard to get noticed.
And it's hard to see every movie, even
so. You're relying on a whole bunch of things. You're relying on your sales agents convincing them to come because of pre-existing relationships. You're relying on, you know, we were literally just putting up guerrilla posters all over the festival, so it felt like there was buzz. You're relying on sending the movie to any reporters ahead of the festival or reviewers
who want to watch it and write about it,
so that those reviews come out right before the movie or right after the movie, so that.
You're on the list of movies to catch at the festival.
And all that is stuff that you're basically trying to do so that there's a chance you sell it.
I've had some friends who basically make a movie and they don't really think about the sale part of it.
Sure.
They've got their indie feature made and they are excited to, you know, they apply to Sundance and then they don't get in. And then so they think, okay, I want to get into a festival. And so they might go to a festival. Or they get into a festival, but it's not one that has a market. But the festival loves it and wants to program it. You know,
You whatever. Feel
Chicago
special, right?
Not to pick on Chicago, but like the Chicago Film Festival doesn't have sales agents going there to buy movies. But man, the Chicago programmer wrote me back and wants my movie.
Sure.
So then it's so tempting to go, but if you premiere your movie there, you're not going to sell it there.
Sure.
You know,
and once you premiere somewhere in a country or a continent, you've burned your premiere at that continent. So once you're at Chicago, you're never going to be at TIFF.
Well, it kind of depends on how you slice things and it depends on what your prospects are, right?
Sure.
Like if TIFF has already rejected you,
Yes. Right?
Then it's like, okay, well, I can have my West Coast premiere, my East Coast premiere.
So we had
that's what I was getting to. Basically, if you're making a feature and you've got a lot of money tied up in this movie, something we did that we kind of happened upon, but what ended up being a great strategy.
It was on
purpose,
highly recommend, but it was totally a guess.
was
some people were like, this is crazy, but you guys are brilliant.
it was basically like, you know how people, when they start making their movie, they put an announcement out?
Mm-hmm.
Like they cast the movie with some sort of namey,
sure, there's
whatever.
A deadline
and,
post.
And they put it in deadline.
Yeah, yeah.
We intentionally never, ever announced the movie.
Interesting.
Because we knew, we don't know how long this movie is going to take to finish. And we don't know how long it's going to take to get into a festival.
Yeah, there's only awareness you can have around a movie.
Not only that, but we didn't want it to feel like old news.
Sure. Yeah.
So we didn't want someone to be able to Google it.
And we asked ourselves.
And say like, oh, wait, this announcement happened 2 years ago. We wanted it to always feel like the movie just finished. So what happened was.
And we even asked ourselves, like, what benefit does a cast announcement really have? Like
likes
to the movie.
On Facebook.
Exactly. We were like, it doesn't actually help us.
Ooh, it feels good though.
Yeah. It's an ego boost with no impact to the movie.
Sure.
So we just said,
I think there's also a flip side of like, if you're trying to like say, you know, raise some finishing funds,
sure,
or something like that.
And that would be a benefit.
Google your movie.
Right.
They're like, oh, cool. Some deadline. It's bona fide. There's a, you know, would be the flip side to that.
Sure.
The counterpart.
I mean, I think the risk for us just felt like it outweighed the benefit. Cause what happened was, we actually submitted a rough cut to Sundance and didn't get in. Then we, you know, really tried to polish it up a bit more. We submitted to South By and didn't get in. And there were still temp VFX and slugs and stuff in there. And so we were like, okay, we're going to finish the movie before we apply to Toronto. We finished the movie.
And we played Telluride as well.
Remind me about in terms of the deadlines for all of those festivals. So Sundance is first, South By second, is that
the
right?
The deadline for Sundance,
like,
is,
how much time
is in late summer,
yeah. Uh-huh.
And the festival's in January.
Right.
The deadline for South By, I'm not exactly sure,
like,
I remember, is probably like
it's
December.
Like now, basically. No, oh, no. South By is like the September, October. Yeah.
And
or regular deadline.
But with each one, we said, we just finished the movie.
Yeah,
it's just a week
it's still
old.
Rough, you know, mm-hmm, whatever.
Sure.
So even when we really finished it for Toronto, we said, this movie has just been finished.
But to your point, the reason we're telling the story is, if you got through all the A-tier festivals and you've never announced it and they all reject you and you come back around.
But not only
you could then start doing the B-tier ones that.
Sure.
Chicago.
You could premiere,
but you've never announced it.
Yeah, sure.
Because no one knows that it's not just been created.
But not only that, if you got rejected from all the A-tier festivals where there's sales markets, you could go to sales agents,
mm-hmm,
and say, look, here's my movie. It didn't get into the festivals, but no one knows it exists. No one's ever seen it.
Right.
I want you to be the sales agent. What's our plan for getting it out there, getting it seen? It's still a virginal thing.
Right, rather than having premiered somewhere that's less impressive than it could be.
Yeah, yeah, you can get their help in making a sales plan. That's my advice.
They sell movies all the time. Anyway, it worked out in our favor. People were like, I never heard of this movie.
Yeah, one buyer right before TIFF was banging down CAA's door saying, how come I've never heard of this movie? I have the best tracking people in the business.
It was driving them nuts.
And it made them salivate because... Sure. They felt like it was
a secret. Yeah,
he ended
up
offering us hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy the movie before it premiered, just because we wouldn't give it to him
without seeing it.
That's awesome.
Killer.
We should probably wrap up soon, but I want to ask one question. I hope, try to give me the quickest answer you can. But who approached who to co-direct? Like, is that not was that never a big deal?
No, well, basically we had
part
done
of the DNA of the project.
We just kind of, well, we did smaller things together
over
and
years.
All of those just sort of came together naturally. Like, hey, I'm shooting this commercial. Do you want to help me out do it? Or, you know, that type of thing. But then this project was on purpose. It was like, we're both struggling. We both have the same problem.
And we knew we enjoyed working together. Like we had done at that point, probably almost like 10 small things.
But
together.
Also the big catalyst was, I think we're both individually pretty talented directors. I would say individually, we're pretty poor writers. And so co-writing, because it's so hard to write. The collaboration that comes from writing is essential, I think, for both of us. Like, it's what makes the product. If we'd both written scripts by ourselves, which we've done many, they weren't as good as doing it together. And then once you've co-written it,
the co-directing is just sort of the next extension of that, because you know every beat and you know all of that. But
would you say that some of that is accountability to a partner, and then the rhythms of like doing those table reads and all of that stuff?
I think it's, well, that's, those are very, very helpful. Both of those things you mentioned are very helpful, but I also just think it's the brainstorming. Mm-hmm. It's the, sure, you know, spitballing back. And then this scene, this happens. I don't like that. What if this happens? Oh, what if that? And then this. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of build on each other to make something better.
And often when you're writing, you'll be like, yeah, this is fine. No, notice this. That'll be all right.
It's good enough.
Your partner will be like, no.
Or I'll come back to that or something.
Yeah.
Totally.
Right. Well, are you guys cool to hang out for some unpaid endorsements?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Cool.
Unpaid endorsements. So I'll kick it off. I've got two. One that unfortunately is Los Angeles only. So apologies, everyone. But
sorry, Zach.
I'll make it up for you guys. Zach, you've still got time.
All right.
So KCRW, our local NPR affiliate, did the second time around a tortilla tournament where 50 different Mexican restaurants all competed in a bracket style competition to be throned as both either the best in show or best corn or best flour tortilla. It's hosted by Gustavo Arellano, who is literally the guy who wrote the book on tacos. You may recognize him from, he's in that episode of Ugly Delicious where like they go to tour taco places. Anyway, I like tortillas, you guys. I'm going to spoil it for you. My taco shop, home state, won best flour tortilla in Los Angeles.
What? Have they been to El Pollo Loco?
I've never been there. I got to go. I love flour tortillas.
Oh, man, you got to go.
I'm a flour tortilla connoisseur. I live off Melrose and Highland.
Oh, you're pretty close.
Yeah, close enough. There's home one state. There's a Los Feliz one and an Echo
home
Park
state.
One. Home Highland State. Park. Pardon me, you're right. Highland Park, yeah. Home state, it's like Tex-Mex. So it's like they specialize in breakfast tacos. They're great. And also, I literally will walk down and buy a dozen tortillas to take home and then like make tacos for the rest of the week. So it was really nice to know that I'd been spending a lot of money on the best flour tortillas in Los Angeles. So, but
that was number one. What was number two?
Well, so they were number one flour. La Monarca is number one in both best in show, basically, and also corn tortilla.
But you said you had two unpaid endorsements.
Oh, so my second unpaid endorsement. I thought you wanted to talk more about tortillas. So. So my second unpaid endorsement. Previously on the show, we had a guest, Jeanette McCurdy, and she reminded me of maybe my very favorite Birthday Boy sketch, which was a IFC sketch show. And so it's a sketch called Goldhoff and Seinstein, where she plays a pop star, and these two like 50s style songwriting duos try to write songs for her, but they can't ever write in any other voice but their own. And so all of their songs reference how they are like Goldhoff and Seinstein, and like they should be writing a Britney Spears style song. So I really love it, and that'll be in the show notes. So those are my two endorsements, cool. Guys.
Amazing. Good endorsements. I have one. Did anyone else watch the Apple keynote today?
I watched a little bit of it.
I didn't, but my mom gave me a hard time about not doing it.
Not doing what?
Not watching the keynote.
Is your mom a big Apple
She
fan?
Has some Apple stock, so she's how are you not paying attention to this?
I own this company.
Yeah.
That's well, how good she for feels. Your mom. That's
yeah.
awesome.
Yeah.
I watched it at the Starbucks Reserve until Matt called me, because I guess we had a call scheduled at 11:30. But so the iPhone 11 Pro is being released.
I'm sure not a lot of people have heard about Apple, so it's really good that you're helping the word get out there.
So by the time this airs, like, it'll already be out and available for sale. But they had Sean Baker, filmmaker that made
I saw that,
Tangerine
yeah.
with
yeah.
the iPhone on, and they had the guy, some guy from Filmic Pro, the app.
Yeah, the CTO.
Okay, CTO. And so you know this, Zach, obviously, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners do already, but so the new Filmic Pro with the new iPhone will let you shoot with the three different lenses at the same time. You can shoot like a telephoto.
Simultaneously?
In a wide shot. Yeah,
all three lenses, because the Apple Pro, iPhone Pro phone has three lenses, a super wide, a wide, and a long lens.
And it
also shoot all three at once.
Also lets you shoot the reverse camera at the same time.
So you're shooting that's yourself new, and the three cameras.
It's a new multicam setup right
yeah.
there.
I mean, they're all from the same angle.
We're going to see some indie films made that way, and it's going to be very weird.
Yeah.
I like Sean Baker was trying to, like, talk about, like, how, now I could shoot two sizes at the same time. Like, you're like, no, nah, you wouldn't do that.
Though. You would don't want to do that.
But, somebody's going to do that.
But yeah. You would do that for, like, literally you could shoot an interview or something.
Gives and you edit somewhere it. To cut.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I thought that was
good work for
cool.
interviews. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so I am not a self-help book type person. I don't
however.
Know. However.
Yeah, that's what we all say.
This book.
As we're reading The Artist's Way.
Called. Yeah, I've read The Artist's Way.
My girlfriend's doing her pages. Just.
I didn't keep up with The Artist's Way. I tried. Whatever.
Matt's wife. What? 1,500 days?
Something like that.
Wow.
Good something
job,
absurd.
Matt's wife. Yeah, yeah. The book called Mindset by Carol Dweck changed my life.
Hmm.
It was recommended to me by a screenwriting teacher named Corey Mandel, who teaches classes here in LA. And basically what this book is about, she's a social psychologist who did research on successful people.
Mm-hmm.
And she has this sort of, continuum in the book where everyone falls somewhere on the continuum between fixed mindset and growth mindset. And what it entails is, how do you think about skills, talents? How do you think about why someone's successful? Are you a great pianist? I see your piano over here. Do you play piano because you were born with musical talent? Or that would be fixed mindset. Or can people develop any skill that they practice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which is be more growth mindset. I was raised very fixed. You know, parents always telling me, oh, you're smart at this subject, but you're not so good at baseball. Stay away from that. You know, basically trying
that
to
filmmaking thing.
Yeah. But trying to put me in whichever box they thought I belonged in. You know, some of them were positive boxes, but still fixed. The problem with being fixed mindset and the reason it plateaus people is because everyone encounters obstacles in life.
Sure.
And even if you think you're good at something, the minute you encounter an obstacle when you're a fixed mindset person, it can be crushing.
Mm-hmm. You don't have any tools to overcome that obstacle.
Yeah.
Right?
And yeah. Oh my God, I thought I was good at this. I thought I was good at acting and I didn't get that role. What does that mean about me as a person? So the reason he was introducing it in a writing class is because a lot of people are taught or told at some point, you're not a very good writer. You're good at structure, but not a character.
You're a dialogue person.
Yeah.
And so it's very fixed. And what he was trying to communicate to us was, you can practice these things and get better and become a better writer by practice.
Well, one of the things he says is the people that are really good at structure just keep working on structure because they're afraid to try dialogue and vice versa.
Right.
And so, right, doesn't he try to analyze, like, you're a structure person. I need you to just work on dialogue for the next
month. Corey has this thing about conceptual people are good at structure and intuitive people are better at character or dialogue or whatever, more feeling the characters. And he makes people cross-train by practicing the thing you think you're not good at.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, just in my whole life, this idea of being more growth mindset oriented completely changed my life. So that, and it takes practice to reframe in your head, like when something bad happens to you, it's not about you and your skills and your talents and your essential nature. It's about, huh, that was interesting. I wonder how I can learn from that to become better at this.
Right.
Which is so powerful just in all aspects of your life. And so even though it's a little bit cheesy, I wanted to share that with you guys today.
Yeah. And one more time, what's the title of the book?
The title's called Mindset. And Mindset. It's by Carol Dweck, Dweck.
Awesome. I love that. Yeah. I've always been like the person that's frustrated ever since I was a kid when someone's like, yeah, I'm not really a math person. My brain just doesn't work that way. So I don't do like, are you an English person or a math person? You know? And to me, it's always like, well, you could totally be both.
Well, I always thought I was bad because of probably how things my parents said to me when I was very young. Bad at foreign languages and bad at music.
Oh,
and so I never really tried,
right,
you know?
Right.
But then a couple years ago, I decided, well, first of all, I spent a semester in Spain and I could speak Spanish by the end of it. It's like, wait, maybe it just takes a lot of practice. And then also a couple years ago, I was like, I think it was Apple, you know, the GarageBand had the lessons where you could teach yourself guitar.
Yeah.
I was like, maybe I'll just do that. You know, I bought a cheap guitar and I taught myself a couple songs and I'm like, you just fail enough and you get to be able to play a song.
And they go a little something. like this.
So anyway, it's just like for writing, for anything, I think it's just very like healthy.
Killer.
Cool.
Awesome. Zach.
Now for the best.
Yeah.
Bring it home. It's
not life-changing, but it is something I've been enjoying.
You can't say Shotluster.
By Shotluster.
Do you still want to give out free copies of Shotluster?
Oh, yeah. We give... You just email... Just shoot it at shotluster.com. We'll send you a free copy. The thing I've been doing recently, which... Originally, I rejected and thought it was stupid and kind of didn't want to do and have come back to years later and actually been quite enjoying it.
Meditation.
No. Is actually that website, which probably lots of people know about. It's not like a hidden secret, is masterclass.com.
When
I first like checked it out, there was like just a few things on
there. They have so many ads. It feels like, it's a little bit of a hard sell, guys.
That challenging 50-50. Yeah. I love it. That's Ron Howard ad.
Yeah.
Matt always references and no one knows what.
And that is not true. Like, I changed my profile photo to that screen grab and I got so many comments.
So I sort of in the last like few months, I'm a huge podcast guy. I listen to podcasts every day. And then I just started, for some reason, I guess I saw one of those ads. I can't remember even which person it was, but I kind of subscribed and they give you the option of like subscribing for one thing for like $150 or all of them for $200. And what I was surprised by, which is the reason I'm sort of telling people about it, is there's like so many more on there than I even ever knew. And I just assumed they had like one writer, one director. They had Ron Howard and, you know, as the director.
Sure.
And then
Aaron Sorkin.
And I saw the Aaron Sorkin one. That was the one I originally signed up for. And I was kind of like, oh, well, he's just kind of saying like basic, this isn't a master class. He's just sort of telling you to have.
It's like a good lecture.
Yeah, he's telling you to have conflict in your scenes. Like, okay. So I basically just hated it. And actually I got a refund when I first asked for it. But now I've been actually just like, there's so many, you know, they've got David Lynch on there just saying wacky, crazy stuff.
Speaking of meditation.
And they have like Werner Herzog telling you never to have a lawyer. And they've just got like crazy.
Serena Williams telling you how to.
And I just finished listening to all of Chris Hadfield, who's an incredible astronaut, just talking all about space exploration. And it's in some ways, it's now supplemented my podcast listening. It's
can
just
you
like,
listen to it without watching
it? Yeah. So you can download them offline and you can also hit play and just listen to them on your headphones. And most of them aren't visual anyway. So it's really just sort of like a 6 or 7 hour podcast of someone who's really, really good at one thing. And at first I went through all the writing ones and there was like R.L. Stine who wrote all the like Goosebumps. Sure. But I actually found everything he had to say hilarious and interesting. And he was just a wacky character that had, and I just ended up surprisingly, I've enjoyed it more like a podcast from interesting people creating content. Right. It's just
almost
like
TED Talk.
Yeah, it's like a TED Talk, but they're more personal because they're just sort of sitting down and talking. And now I've started to sort of like Adam was saying, listen to ones that, you know, that I have no. I subscribe because of the film ones. I was like, I want to hear what Ron Howard has to say about directing.
But you're like, how do I do a great scrambled egg?
Yeah, well, there was ones that were like Italian cooking. And like, I was like, well, I'll just, I mean, now that you subscribe to all of them, it's like, well, I'll listen to that for an hour. And you end up, I've ended up enjoying it.
And now you are an Olympic level Italian cooker.
And it kind of surprised me. And so if you rejected it and you've seen those ads and you think it's stupid, maybe it is, but I've become someone who's sort of been enjoying it in the way that you just listen to something rather than like thinking I have to do this class.
You're not going to learn
no
life-changing skills, sure. But it's still interesting.
But there's fun little details. Like there is small things like Ron Howard talking about watching Indiana Jones without the sound.
And analyzing and how each shot was
Was actually something I was like, oh, that actually is kind of cool. Smart. And when you're on a plane and you're seeing other people's screens and movies going by without sound, like you can really, like,
what can you pick
what
up
is
that?
Working and what isn't, you know, and just like, I don't know, they all have tiny tidbits, but if
Zach,
you give,
it's like you found a different important angle.
If you gave up on it,
50-50,
like I did and asked for a refund. Exactly. Well done. Maybe worth checking it out again. I mean, it is expensive. It's like $200, but but there's...
Is that for a year?
Yeah. But the main thing that I was surprised by is there is now many, 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 many episodes or different masterclasses on there to the point where it's actually kind of like, wow, there's more in here than I could ever watch.
Yeah. If you really go for it, you can get your money's worth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. I have a masterclass, but I've always kind of been intimidated by the fact that I have to sit and watch
you
the screen.
Watch it,
right? But no, you're saying...
Just listen to it like a podcast. That's all I do, is I listen to it like a podcast.
That's what I should do.
The main very key thing, because it screwed me, make sure to disable your cellular data plan on for just that app.
Oh.
Because sometimes even though you think you've downloaded them, it'll kick into an episode you don't know, and suddenly you've downloaded like a gigabyte and you didn't know.
Yeah.
So pro tip.
That's a good one.
That'd be in my masterclass about masterclass.
Awesome, guys. Well, thanks so much. Where can listeners find out more about you both?
I'm at Twitter at Adam Stein and at Instagram at Adam Stein. I think that's it, right?
Perfect.
S-T-E-I-N.
And I'm same thing. I'm at Zach Lepofsky.
And Z-A-C-H.
Z-A-C-H. And you can also check out our movie Freaks at freaks.movie is the website.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
So if you want to check out if it's playing near you, and if you have any other questions, feel free to reach out to us. We love just answering random questions from people. So
and the Twitter's the best way to reach out to you guys?
Yeah, Twitter, Instagram.
Yeah,
you know, killer.
Or email just shootitpod@chatlister.com.
Yeah, if you want to talk to my mom about a free copy.
There you go.
She'll forward you an email if it's addressed to Zach.
So nice. Cool. Well, thanks so much, guys. We'll have all of the stuff that we talked about on our show notes at justshootitpod.com. You can email us any questions at justshootitpod@gmail.com. We're across all social media at justshootitpod. It's that simple. I'm at Mr. Matt Benmo.
And I'm at O Kaplan on Instagram. And this episode was edited by Sarah Weirda. Our producer is Madeline Rosewatt. Our webmaster is Ewan Williams. And the music you're listening to right now is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazard. And we will catch you next time.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.